The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
And good evening to, or rather good morning to everybody. This is Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call in Singapore, wishing you a wonderful weekend ahead and hoping that I can send you on your way with some enlightened comment from the Wake Up Call during this coming hour. Well, what is more important than survival? On planet Earth, nothing. The most basic rule of life is survive. The biological imperative of living things is to perpetuate their existence. Survive, procreate, further the species. It is hardwired in the DNA of every living organism. Those that do not succeed in satisfying these imperatives are described as maladaptive, not fit to survive or compete in the natural world. It is the most rudimentary law in biology, applicable from single-cell protozoa to human beings. And it exists in the world of organizations. Entities that are maladaptive, corporations, non-profits, governments, eventually succumb to their own mortality and collapse. This is as it should be, as there are no reasons dysfunctional corporations unable to perform their most basic function, survival, should be preserved. This is especially true when it comes to financial firms, banks, insurers, investment houses, whose prime responsibility is identifying potential reward and managing risk. The failure of survival raises a compelling question. Why should firms that fail their most basic charge, survival, be bailed out? If on their own they are too incompetent merely to continue to exist, what other manner of disasters live within their balance sheets, legal obligations, managerial skill sets? A firm that is so reckless and irresponsible as to have put its own survival at risk is not only maladaptive, it has failed its most basic duty. If a company's management demonstrates an inability to perform that most basic of functions, we should not assume they managed to do anything else competently. Indeed, our assumption should be that they are likely unable to perform their duties competently and plan accordingly. Our working presumption should be that maladaptive corporations are not very competent at anything. The events of the past year have demonstrated this to be all too factually correct. The firms that were unable to survive on their own without a government bailout, AIG, Bank of America, Bear Stearns, Citigroup, etc., were rife with incompetence. That is precisely what we have learnt since the bailouts. If I informed you that a corporate entity was so reckless and incompetent that it was unable to ensure its own survival, would you bet the rest of its behavior was responsible or reckless? Competent or incompetent? If they put their very survival at risk, why wouldn't the rest of their behavior on issues that mattered less be performed at a higher standard? Well, ladies and gentlemen, as we have learned, they weren't. The same managerial incompetence, short-termism, inappropriate compensation schemes that led to these firms' downfall was woven throughout their entire range of companies. From corporate culture to leadership to staffing to organizational procedures, failed companies turn out to fail in many different ways. Here's a short list of colossal failures. Some of this maladaptive corporate behavior led to their demise. Other examples were marked by inadequacies that were just below the surface, waiting to wreak more havoc following their bailouts. Consider these and ask yourself if they were discharged in any more competent fashion than the behavior that led to these firms' insolvencies. Not just bad, but terrible loans. Haphazard securitization. False affidavits, perjury, fraud, hiring grossly incompetent or criminal third parties, MERS or M-E-R-S, fabricating a shadow legal system, god-awful acquisitions. You know, we could continue with this exercise, but the point is clear. When you save a failed institution, when you bail out a bank whose own behavior led to its demise, you are also saving a parade of horrible antics within that firm. The passage of time merely reveals the rest of the incompetence of these firms that is below the surface. Right, and with that, ladies and gentlemen, I will give you my information. Again, I am Richard Martin. This is the wake-up call coming to you from Singapore through the studios at PRN in New York City. And we have a toll-free telephone number, ladies and gentlemen. And it is 888-874-4888. Now, there are various things that this phone number will accomplish, and others that it will not. It will not buy you a house, it will not buy you ice cream, and it will not take you on a vacation to the Azores. But what it will do is to allow you free and unfettered entry into the wake-up call, where you may lodge your questions, your rants, and your comments of one sort or another at will and at any time. And once more, I will give you the number. It is 888-874-4888. Please call in any time during the hour. My email and IM is open, and I will receive information from our engineer that you're on the line, and I will take your call right away. If you'd rather send in an email, you can do that too, and the email address to write to, if you would rather write in your questions, which many, many people do, and you can do that during the hour too, because my email page is open, ready to receive your emails, and the email address is rm@gfawd.com. Once more, the email address, rm for Richard Martin, gfawd for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, the company where I work, .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, if you want to call in your problems and personal issues to me and you would like to have a consultation with me, you may do that by calling my direct line, and that is a number in Sarasota, which comes through to Singapore, at area code 941-441-1682. Once more, it is 941-441-1682. Okay, well, now, I very seldom talk about the rights and wrongs of how money is allocated and apportioned in the United States. It borders on politics, and as you know, I'm not interested in setting any political fires on the wake-up call. But I do think that it's worth examining just where the money really is, not as a moral question, but as an answer to those who say there is simply no money to deal with the problems. You know, right now we're living through a perfect storm here. And I'm not talking about the impending dangers facing any particular political system. I'm talking about the dangers facing American democracy. First, as I'm sure you know by now, income in America is now more concentrated in fewer hands than it's been in 80 years. Almost a quarter of total income generated in the United States is going to the top 1% of Americans, the top 0.1% of Americans now earn as much as the bottom 120 million of you. Who are these people? With the exception of few entrepreneurs like Bill Gates, they are top executives of big corporations and Wall Street, hedge fund managers, and private equity managers. They include the Koch brothers, whose wealth increased by billions last year, and who are now funding Tea Party candidates across the nation. Which gets us to the second part of the perfect storm. A relatively few Americans are buying the democratic institutions as never before, and they're doing it completely in secret. Hundreds of millions of dollars are pouring into advertisements for and against candidates without a trace of where the dollars are coming from. They are laundered through a handful of groups. Fred Malik, whom you may remember as deputy director of Richard Nixon's notorious Committee to Re-elect the President, dubbed Creep in the Watergate scandal, is running one of them. Republican operative Karl Rove runs another. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, yet another. The Supreme Court's Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission made it all possible. The Federal Election Commission says only 32% of groups paying for election ads are disclosing the names of their donors. By comparison, in the 2006 midterm, 97% disclosed. In 2008, almost half disclosed. We're back to the late 19th century when the lackeys of robber barons literally deposited six sacks of cash on the desks of friendly legislators. The public never knew who was bribing whom. Just before it recessed, the House passed a bill that would require that the names of all such donors be publicly disclosed. But it couldn't get through the Senate. Every Republican voted against it. And to see how far the GOP has come, nearly 10 years ago, campaign disclosure was supported by 48 out of 54 Republican senators. Well, here's the third part of the perfect storm. Most Americans are in trouble. Their jobs, incomes, savings, and even homes are on the line. They need a government that's working for them, not for the privileged and the powerful. Yet their state and local taxes are rising and their services are being cut. Teachers and firefighters are being laid off. The roads and bridges they count on are crumbling. Pipelines are leaking. Schools are dilapidated and public libraries are being shut. There's no jobs bill to speak of, no WPA to hire those who can't find jobs in the private sector. Unemployment insurance doesn't reach half of the unemployed. Washington says nothing can be done. There's no money left. No money? The marginal income tax rate on the very rich is the lowest it's been in more than 80 years. Under President Dwight Eisenhower, who no one would have accused of being a radical, it was 91%. Now it's 36%. Congress is even fighting over whether to end the temporary Bush tax cut for the rich and return them to the Clinton top tax of 39%. Much of the income of the highest earners is treated as capital gains anyway, subject to a 15% tax. The typical hedge fund and private equity manager paid only 17% last year. Their earnings were not exactly modest. The top 15 hedge fund managers earned an average of $1 billion. Congress won't even return to the estate tax in place during the Clinton administration, which applied only to those in the top 2% of incomes. It won't limit the tax deductions of the very rich, which include interest payments on multi-million dollar mortgages. Yet Wall Street refuses to allow homeowners who can't meet mortgage payments to include their primary residence in personal bankruptcy. There's plenty of money to help stranded Americans, just not the political will to raise it. And at the rate secret money is flooding your political system, even less political will in the future. As I said, the perfect storm. An unprecedented concentration of income and wealth at the top. A record amount of secret money flooding democracy and a public becoming increasingly angry and cynical about a government that's raising its taxes, reducing its services, and unable to get it back to work. We're losing democracy to a different system. It's called plutocracy. All right, well, U.S. banks repossessed a record total of 102,134 homes in September. That was the very first time that home repossessions in the United States have ever surpassed the 100,000 mark during 1 month. Household spending for the middle fifth of all U.S. income earners was down 3.5% in 2009. That was the steepest one-year decline since records began being kept back in 1984. The number of Americans enrolled in the food stamp program passed the 41 million mark for the first time ever during the month of June. The number of Americans enrolled in the food stamp program has set a new all-time record for 20 consecutive months. The Census Bureau says that 43.6 million Americans are now living in poverty, and according to them, that is the highest number of poor Americans that they have ever recorded in 51 years of record keeping. It is projected that the major financial firms on Wall Street will pay out an all-time record of $144 billion in compensation for 2010. As of last March, U.S. banks had an inventory of 1.1 million foreclosed homes, which was a new all-time record and which was up 20% from 1 year earlier. Earlier in 2010, the average time needed to find a job had risen to a record 35.2 weeks. The U.S. government has accumulated a national debt that is rapidly approaching $14 trillion. The U.S. government has accumulated a national debt that is rapidly approaching $14 trillion, and the national debt sets a new all-time record every single month with no end in sight. Well, in the run-up to World War I, something that I just came up with a few days ago, I thought you would be interested to know this. In the run-up to World War I, an influential book was written by General von Bernhardi, titled Germany and the Next War. The book manifests Germany's frustration and militancy. Von Bernhardi proclaims that with her scientific and intellectual achievements, Germany should have a more prominent role in world affairs, more colonial trophies with access to petroleum reserves. Germany's GDP had passed that of Great Britain and France, and they now wanted more respect. France and Great Britain were maneuvering as best they could to keep Germany, a perceived threat, out of the game. Bernhardi's book also argues that war was not only a justifiable means to achieve that goal, but even an obligation of Germany's leadership. And now, in 2010, we witness the wide distribution of a book entitled Unhappy China, which expresses China's frustration with their current position. The similarity in tone is uncanny. China is on its way to becoming the second economy of the world, yet China is not, quote-unquote, embraced as a member of the G8 and has almost no influence in the IMF and World Bank. China is frustrated with the West's meddling in internal affairs, and with the humiliation endured by the Olympic torch run that was, in their perception, disgraced by demonstrations. All the maneuvering by the West now is to keep China out of the game and treat potential threat Does this have automatic conflict baked into it? Well, the U.S. Federal Reserve is getting ready, as I'm sure you've heard, to conduct another gigantic bailout of the big banks, but this time virtually nobody in the mainstream media will use the term bailout, and the American people are going to get a lot less upset about it. You see, one lesson that was learned during the last round of bank bailouts was that the Americans really, really do not like it when the U.S. Congress votes to give money to the big banks. So this time, the financial powers that be have figured out a way around that. Instead of going through the massive headache of dealing with the U.S. Congress, the Federal Reserve is simply going to print money and give it directly to the banks. To be more precise, the Federal Reserve is going to use a procedure known as quantitative easing, ladies and gentlemen, if you've heard that one before, to print money out of thin air in order to purchase large quantities of troubled assets, such as mortgage-backed securities, from the biggest U.S. banks at well above market price. Some are already openly wondering if this next round of quantitative easing is going to be the biggest bank robbery in history. Most Americans won't understand these backdoor bailouts well enough to get upset about them, but that doesn't mean that they won't be just as bad or even worse than the last round of bailouts. In the end, all of the ultimate inflation that this new round of quantitative easing is going to cause is going to be a hidden tax on all of us. Now, I say ultimate inflation because right now we are in a period of deflation, as I have spent so much time talking about and proving and sending out in terms of articles on the Internet to my distribution group. But the inflation, if this goes on, will come some years down the line with a fury that will surprise all of us and be a very grave threat to your very livelihood, ladies and gentlemen. So watch out for it. Anyway, these new backdoor bailouts are going to be working something like this. One, the big U.S. banks have massive quantities of junk mortgage-backed securities that are worth little to nothing that they desperately want to get rid of. Two, they convince the Federal Reserve, which the big banks are in part owners of, to buy up these toxic assets at way above market price. Three, the Federal Reserve creates massive amounts of money out of thin air to buy up all of these troubled assets. The public is told that all of this quantitative easing is necessary to stimulate the U.S. economy. And four, the big banks are recapitalized and have got massive amounts of bad mortgage securities off their hands. The Federal Reserve has found a way to pump hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of dollars into the economy, and most of the American people are none the wiser. But this isn't the only way that the Federal Reserve forks over massive amounts of cash to the U.S. banks, the big banks. The Fed lends huge quantities of nearly interest-free money to big U.S. big banks, which they turn around and invest in U.S. treasuries, which bring in a return of 3% or so. In essence, it's a legalized way for the big U.S. banks to make mountains and mountains of free money. And risk-free. The truth is that the Federal Reserve does whatever it can to ensure that the big U.S. banks stay fat and happy. Of course, when it comes to the small banks, they are considered not big enough for bailouts, so if they get into trouble, they'll be allowed to go belly up. Ladies and gentlemen, don't let anyone ever fool you into thinking that the U.S. banking system has a level playing field. For weeks, Federal Reserve officials have been coming out and have been dropping hints about how important it is for them to take action and implement another round of quantitative easing in order to help stimulate the U.S. economy. In fact, in one of Bernanke's recent speeches, he was practically salivating at the thought of printing more money. But nobody ever really bothers to ask who is going to be the first to get their hands on all this money that the Fed is going to pump into the economy. The answer, of course, is obvious. It's going to be the big banks, the same banks, the very same banks that are part owners of the Federal Reserve itself and that have tremendous influence over the Fed policies. Ladies and gentlemen, I assure you, printing more money and giving it to the banks is not going to solve the economic problems of the United States. In fact, it's just going to make them worse. But unfortunately, American voters get no say about any of this. America's national monetary policy is in the hands of an unelected central bank that does pretty much whatever it wants. All right, let's have a few emails before we go to our break. Starting off with Nikki, who writes in saying, "Hi Richard, I would love your advice on something. My 61-year-old mother was laid off from her job 2.5 years ago and has been unable to find another job ever since. I am 33 and still live at home since she can't make it on her own. I pay the mortgage and she pays the other bills. Since unemployment ran out months ago, she started living off home equity lines of credit, but that is also now running out. As foreclosures and what the banks have been doing has been in the news a lot lately, do you think we should chance it and stop paying the mortgage and just concentrate on other bills? What are your thoughts? There is no other family that can help, and I can't contribute more than I already am. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts, Nikki." All right, now, Nikki, I've said this before, and basically I must tell you I have had this question over and over again. In fact, this is definitely by far the most asked question that I get, and I've plucked out your email among many, but I assure you there are others that I'm just not able to get to, but the answer is always the same. If you are genuinely unable to pay your mortgage or are hurting to the point at which it becomes really almost impossible to pay the mortgage, your very first phone call should be to a lawyer in your state. And you should have a very serious discussion for which you should expect to pay out several hundred dollars to get a good appraisal of your situation, and you should follow to a T what the lawyer tells you to do. Do not take matters into your own hands. If you do, then you will almost certainly regret it. Because these banks and mortgage companies know a lot more about the law than you do. And if they choose to come after you, and you live in a state where they actually can do so, you will be in very grave jeopardy. So whereas I think that in many cases it is prudent to consider seriously not paying the mortgage, be sure to get legal advice before you start running down that particular road. All right, thanks, Nikki. Let us now come to Chris in New Haven, Connecticut, who says, "Dear Richard, could you please explain your position on taxation? Where is the balance between the necessary and that which will impede economic stability? How can a government, federal, state, or local, tax effectively? All the best, Chris, New Haven, Connecticut." All right, Chris, well, let me ask you a question. Unfortunately, this your comment came by way of an email and not through the telephone, because this would be a good one for a chat. Let's posit that we took away all the wars in which America is currently involved and fighting and brought all the troops home. Do you know that that would take in almost all of the tax that is paid into the system by the people of America? So basically, what I would answer to you is, which would you prefer? Have lots of juicy little wars going on all over the world for which you are paying directly by means of your taxes, or give up the wars and the taxes? And you see, that's what Ron Paul means when he says that we really shouldn't be paying income tax. In fact, income tax per se is unconstitutional. And there are a few people even today who do not pay income tax every year, and the authorities have actually come to terms with this and left them alone. Very few people, and for heaven's sake, ladies and gentlemen, don't try this at home. But it is, income tax is unconstitutional. It's called taxing your existence. And it was not accounted for by the founding fathers, and it was not written into the Constitution. And although excise taxes are legal and constitutional, income taxes are not. So just think how life would not change one iota if the wars were to stop and you were to stop paying taxes. Everybody would be happier, the economy would probably take off like a rocket, and life would become a lot more pleasant. But do you think that trying to explain that to your congressperson is going to help? Do you think they'd even understand? Do you think they'd even take your phone call, let alone discuss the matter with you? Unfortunately, that's the answer to your question. Not probably what you wanted to hear, Chris, but it's the best I can do. Okay, Steve Kruger has a little rant, which we shall finish with before our break, and it runs as follows. Richard, the Fed's actions fall right in line with your fine assessment of death wish behavior. And for your information, ladies and gentlemen, this was something I talked about at length on our original Sunday evening discussion group programs. We came up with some quite interesting twists and turns on that one. Anyway, once again, the Fed's actions fall right in line with your fine assessment of the death wish behavior. The more you think on death wish, the more your mind turns up material. In the 1940s, we developed the atomic bomb. When it came time to test it, to see if the damn thing worked, the developers Oppenheimer, Teller, and Einstein had no idea the extent of the size of the explosion. They couldn't tell if the chain reaction would be limited in size or if it would continue around the world, destroying us all. In true death wish fashion, they set it off anyway. Sadly for us, economics is not bound by the laws of physics. It is fraught with opinion. When opinion enters the game, the rules seem to go out of the window. We all have opinions, and they are all mostly different. Uncle Ben has set off the bomb called QE, and unlike the first A-bomb, its effects will be felt around the world. Steve Kruger. Thank you, Steve. I will be right back.
The Progressive Radio Network, your premier progressive radio station.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
A state of emergency. No, it's not. It's more of a state of urgency. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm on the radio Fridays at 1 p.m. right here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, offering a different narrative to the news, challenging what we're hearing, what we're seeing, what we're reading, offering another way of understanding what's going on. Join me online on MediaChannel.org and join me here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com Fridays at 1 p.m. Be there or be square.
Let your imagination fly. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Take a trip with me through the literary landscape of Writer's Voice. Join the tour and the conversation as we talk with writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Saturday at noon.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
We're back. also, I'm sure you all heard about the NBER pronouncing the end of the recession in June 2009. Well, would you like to forecast the economy more accurately than them, along with 90% of all economists? Well, ladies and gentlemen, here's all you need to know. Watching financial television, you see the majority of Wall Street economists being bullish. And there was one ridiculous commentator who was heard on CNBC saying, you never have a recession without interest rates rising. Well, let's forgive the poor guy, he's fairly young. Early next year, there will be a lot of unemployed economists, I fear. Economists so often get cause and effect reversed. They say low interest rates are bullish for business, low oil prices are bullish for the economy, low inflation is bullish for monetary policy, etc. Actually, all these factors confirm the deflationary environment and are caused by that. They are confirmations of the bearish environment. Well, here's how to do it better. First of all, forget the dozens of economic statistics, especially the ones published by the U.S. government. Many are what they call seasonally adjusted, which simply means they're good for nothing. Then, several months later, they get substantially revised. How can you know what is important and what is not? Well, here is a guide you should put on your trading computer. Just three things are really what matter. Credit growth, the most important indicator, or lack thereof, and everything else actually follows. You could, in fact, stop right there. But there are two other factors to assist you, although they depend on credit growth. Job growth, which is the most important economic factor dependent on credit growth. If there is no credit growth, then there will be no sustainable job growth. And finally, consumer spending. For stock investors, the most important indicator is consumer spending. Consumer spending is a coincident indicator. When it declines, so does the stock market. It helps us identify the 2007 stock market top in retrospect. If there is no job growth, then spending will depend on consumers who have jobs spending more. This can happen, but it can't be sustainable. And we have seen this over the past 16 months. So there you have it. It's simple. You can skip all the dozens of other economic numbers if you follow these three factors. That's how it would have been possible to know that at the start of this year that the economy would falter. What's the economy doing now? Well, credit card debt has been declining for 21 months and is now down about $150 billion from its peak. Does anyone really believe that the retail sector can flourish with this shrinkage? Commercial and industrial loans to businesses see no rise at all. There is no credit growth. The latest job reports have been absolute disasters, confirming my view that the economy is doing very poorly. The theory of the V-shaped recovery is now being abandoned by the bulls. They are now changing their tune to what they call a soft patch in the economy, just as I predicted. Some economists now mention a square root-shaped recovery. Soon they'll be considering a double dip. But that will also be the optimistic view. A dip infers a slight decline. However, it could be much deeper. The U.S. economy added an average of less than 100,000 jobs a month in the first 7 months of 2010. At least 125,000 to 150,000 jobs are needed just to employ new people entering the labor force. About 250,000 new jobs are needed each month to have an average economic recovery. But ladies and gentlemen, it gets worse. There are now more than 6 million people unemployed and have been for 27 weeks or more. Such a dismal picture hasn't been seen since the 1930s. The government's estimates are much too optimistic as they guess the number of people getting jobs in small firms. that will be corrected for past numbers in February 2011, watch for a nasty surprise. In the meantime, all the jobs numbers are distorted to the positive side. All right, so we have Andy Celsius, who was very kind enough to contribute a new site, an expat site. Ladies and gentlemen, you know that I'm encouraging as many of you as possible to expatriate yourselves to another country. Well, there is a new site which I had not seen before, which Andy alerted us all to, which is, and you might want to take this down, www.expatexchange.com. Now, I'll read that once more. It's an expat site, like some of the others that I have mentioned in the past, International Living being one of them. Here goes, www.expatexchange, all one word, .com. Okay, so one more little piece of housekeeping information for you. There is a new film, I did mention it before, but I've seen lots of good critiques on it. It's playing right now in a theater near you, ladies and gentlemen. It's called Inside Job. Unfortunately, it's not in Singapore yet, but it's one of the few films that I feel very confident in recommending that you go and see. In fact, I think it's a must-see movie. I suggest you get to it as fast as possible. It will leave you with a very bad taste in the mouth. I have seen a couple of interviews with Charles Ferguson, who is the filmmaker. He sounds very interesting, and he has an extremely apt and a precise take on the economic matters of the country. Much, much better than Wall Street 2, the sequel, or they called it. Much better. I would ignore that one and go and see Inside Job. Okay? All right. Well, just a few words on the upcoming elections. Every politician in the U.S. is running for election on a platform of creating new good-paying jobs for Americans. But there is only one problem. Politicians don't create jobs. Businesses create jobs. When politicians and the Federal Reserve get involved in the job market, bad things happen. The excessively low interest rates put in place by the Federal Reserve created a housing bubble that led to the creation of 1 million new construction jobs between 2002 and 2006. Of course, the bubble burst has led to the loss of 2 million construction jobs since 2007. What the myopic pundits on CNBC don't realize, because they're not programmed to think, is that the Greenspan housing bubble created millions of other jobs that had no chance of ever being sustained. The number of realtors grew from 750,000 in 2000 to 1.3 million in 2006. We needed hundreds of thousands of new mortgage brokers and appraisers to falsify documents and not conduct proper due diligence. Wall Street needed to hire thousands of new MBA shysters to create fraudulent packages of toxic mortgages, and the rating agencies needed to hire thousands of Burger King-level thinkers to stamp AAA on the packages of toxic mortgages. These were just the direct jobs created by Easy Al. Home Depot, Lowe's, and a myriad of other home retailers built thousands of stores to service the needs of all these new so-called homeowners and hired hundreds of thousands of clerks, installers, and cashiers. Once the delusion really got going, the equity from the homes generated jobs at car dealers, restaurants, cosmetic surgery centers, cruise lines, and yacht retailers. The reality is that Greenspan, Bernanke, and the rest of the Federal Reserve governors created millions of jobs that were not sustainable. Their policies distorted an already tenuous economic model dependent upon consumer spending, no savings, and delusions of home wealth. All right, a couple more emails. One from Lewis, who says, Richard, when do you think things will start looking dramatically different here in the States? How much longer can the U.S. continue as is before taking drastic measures? Do you think things will remain somewhat as they are for a year or two or three or much less? Regards, Lewis. Well, Lewis, my good friend, this is going to unravel faster than a ball of wool flying from a distance of a height of 10,000 feet. It's all going to come apart very, very quickly, and in my opinion, very, very soon. If I told you that I thought it was already happening, it wouldn't be a lie. But I can't give you chapter and verse right now. But I believe that it is already happening. How many of you now do not know at least two people out of work? And God forbid that you should be the next. But this is a disaster of unparalleled proportions, ladies and gentlemen. And do not underestimate the severity of what is coming down. And do not overestimate the power of any government to do anything about this. Government is as much the problem as anything else. It is most certainly not the solution. Do not listen to what they tell you to do. Do not listen to what they say about what they are going to do, and make your own arrangements accordingly. All right, Nick in New Jersey writes in saying, "Hi Richard, lots of thanks for your enlightening information. You're a blessing. I'm working on returning home to Kenya, and I would like to know what you think lies ahead for Africa as this global economic crisis unfolds. It seems that the level of awareness of impending gloom is unbeknownst to the majority of the citizenry. Do you think that people there adopt the same game plan for survival that you've been suggesting for your American audience? Looking forward to hearing your response Friday. Thanks, Nick in New Jersey." Well, Nick, it is Friday. The only problem is that it's one Friday too late, and I apologize. Now, I've heard that a number of far-sighted entrepreneurs are moving into Africa, positioning themselves for a future which will involve an Africa which is at the bottom of its economic tether right now and can only move up, having suffered innumerable local internecine wars and strife of one sort or another, not unlike Sri Lanka, that I have often posited as being an excellent place to move, either to retire to or to start a new business. Unfortunately, I don't know much about Africa. I can't give you information except to tell you that there are places in Africa of extreme wealth. And if you go there today and you find extreme poverty, you can be fairly sure that at one point in the future when the economy does turn around, which won't be for many, many years yet, ladies and gentlemen, so you have plenty of time on your hands, Africa might not be a bad bet. So in the meantime, I suggest you take a few vacations into that part of the world and see how you like it. Many of these countries speak English, having been British colonies. South Africa itself is a gorgeous country, and many people go there as tourists, very overpopulated, as is many another African country. But it's worth your while to visit. Lots of interesting places to go to, lots of fun things to do. That's about it. Not able to give you much more information, and I apologize about that, but basically, hopefully you have another venue to visit. So, Zaid writes in saying, "Good evening, Richard. When Norman Goldman explained the legal implications of the B of A halting foreclosures, bad title debacle 2 weeks ago, I thought it was hilarious. As your links read the same news started to roll in, I began to think of the real implications and waiting eagerly for your take on it. I was sure you'd do a whole show on it. And in short, it's not funny anymore. It's terrifying. What really scares me is this. How many people left their homes due to foreclosure, didn't know the banks were in bad papers, and could have possibly just stayed in their homes, warm and dry, with their children? Here in Portland, the homeless have begun raising money, quote-unquote, to buy winter gear, specifically tents. Believe me, Richard, I work for a relief agency, so I know these Walmart and Big Five tents are not winter-ready. How many families are in inadequate housing conditions or sleeping in their cars? Regards, Zaid. Well, Zaid, your email speaks for itself. You'd know a lot more about this problem than I think I ever will, so I'm going to leave it at that. But, you know, obviously it is very sad, and, you know, I hope that things will improve quickly, but I fear they will not. And for people living in cold weather, that is not a happy situation. All right. Well, I thought I'd conclude today's offering with some of the most, a list of some of the most overpriced products you might want to avoid. All right. Number one, text messages. How about a 6,000% markup? You can see a full article from Wallet Pop. I won't give you the full email address, but you can go there, Google it, and it'll come up. According to a story in the Chicago Tribune, outgoing 160-character text messages on a cell phone typically costs users 20 cents, while it only costs carriers 0.3 cents to process. That is indeed a 6,000% profit. SMS, or short message service texts, are limited to 160 characters because they, in effect, piggyback on a secondary data channel necessary to coordinate voice communications. Even if you're paying 10 cents per text, that's nothing to laugh out loud about. 600 text messages contain less data than 1 minute of a phone call, testifying Consumers Union policy analysts Joel Kelsey at a hearing before Congress. If text data rates applied, he said, a brief cell conversation would cost customers $120. Well, maybe it's because I'm old and past some of these things, but quite frankly, I prefer to make a phone call anyway. If I've got something to say, I want an answer, and if I want an answer, I want it now. I'm going to call up and find out what the answer is. Sorry, that's just me. I know that's crazy. In Singapore, nobody uses the phone. Everybody uses text messaging. So I'm afraid they're ahead of all of us. Okay, number two, how about bottled water with a 4,000% markup? When the business of bottled water has a documentary about it, you know something's awry. It's all over the place for how much bottled water costs and tap water from home. The website Twilight Earth puts it at a 4,000% markup, partly based on the fact that it takes 5 bottles of water to make the plastic for 1 bottle of water. Blogger Jeff Burden points out that water is prepackaged and is more expensive than a gallon of gas. Since about 40% of bottled water comes from municipal taps, you're better off refilling that plastic bottle at home and toting it around. Just be sure to clean it between uses, will you? Number three, movie theater popcorn. 1,275% markup. When a movie is first released, most of the movie ticket proceeds go to the movie studios, not the theaters. Theater owners try to make up the difference by selling more snacks such as popcorn. It's an effective method. When you pay $6 for a medium-sized bag of popcorn in theaters, you're paying a 1,275% markup compared to the cost of buying a 3-ounce bag of microwavable popcorn sold in a box for about $3 at the store. The average movie theater makes 40% of its profits from concessions. Owners try to keep ticket prices lower, knowing that higher ticket prices would stop you from going in and buying a soda, candy bar, or bag of popcorn. Four, brand name drugs. 200 to 3,000% markup, ladies and gentlemen. Over-the-counter medications were at the top of a recent Wallet Pop list of products to always buy generic and for good ingredient, for good reason. Some estimates put the markup of brand-name drugs at 600,000% when compared to the cost of active ingredients. But on average, the markup, while still high, is much lower than that. In the past year, the cost of brand-name prescriptions has increased nearly 10%, while generics have dropped according to American Association of Retired Persons, AARP. Between April 2009 and March 2010, the average annual drug cost for a person taking three generic medications decreased by $51, while someone taking three brand-name prescription drugs saw their cost increase $706. It was the biggest brand drug price spike in 8 years, the AARP said. Generic drugs are often much cheaper than brand names, but even prices on generic drugs, such as generic Prozac, vary widely. Costco, for example, often sells generics for much less than Walgreens and other pharmacies. Number five, hotel minibar, 400% markup. A 1,300% markup on gummy bears and at the Omni Berkshire Place in New York may be the high point of hotel minibar markups, but unfortunately it's not that outrageous. Markups of 300 to 400% are common at hotel minibars. Oyster.com found some crazy minibar charges at New York City, including $10 for a bottle of water and a $12 toothpaste kit. Do your wallet a favor and keep the fridge door closed. Six, coffee, 300% markup. Thanks, Starbucks. Nowadays, it's pretty common to pay a markup of 300% or more for coffee, and even those huge profit margins still may not keep your neighborhood coffee shop in business. Just keep in mind, that $3 cup of coffee, assuming you don't tip, add shots, or buy some fancy concoction, that you buy at the corner cafe can be made at home for a quarter. Number seven, wine. How about a 300% markup? It's not unheard of for a restaurant to pay $5 wholesale for a bottle of wine and charge a customer $25 for the same bottle. A glass of wine can have a higher markup because the bottle could be thrown away if all of it isn't used. The San Francisco Chronicle's food critic says that a markup of 2.5 times the wholesale price of wine is fair at restaurants to cover the cost of stocking the wines, serving them, and still reaping a healthier profit. A $10 wholesale bottle should cost the diner about $25 and about $15 retail. Since wine is a restaurant's biggest profit area, don't expect to bring in your own bottle and drink it for free. A corkage fee of $10 to $20 is likely. Always call ahead and ask. Number eight, greeting cards. 200% markup. The best greeting cards anyone ever keeps are those made by hand. Either the crayon scribble of a child or a heartfelt note by a friend are more likely to be kept forever than a generic card bought at the grocery store for $2 or $4. So why do people pay the 200% markup that stores put on greeting cards? For the convenience. Buying that mass-produced card is a lot easier than making one at home. If you don't want to draw your own card, then print one out online. Paper and ink cost money, but printing them at home for virtually nothing beats paying $4 at the store. And number nine, hotel in-room movies. 200% markup. Like the rip-off at the minibar, in-room movies are another way for hotels to stick it to your wallet while you're stuck in a room with nothing to do. Why risk trying to find a local theater when you can pay 200% more for the ease of watching the movie in the safety of your room? If you want to refrain from buying the $10 to $15 movie rentals in a hotel, bring your computer with you on trips and either bring your own DVDs, find a local movie rental store, or bring your latest Netflix movie from home and then mail it when you're done. If you have a free Wi-Fi at the hotel, stream movies from Netflix. Some hotels have DVD players in rooms or loan them to guests. So if you don't want to lug your laptop with you, call ahead and see if that is an option. And finally, number 10, pre-cut vegetables and fruit. 40% markup. Like many of these overpriced products, pre-cut vegetables and fruit are a way to save time. But it's time you're paying for, sometimes as much as 40% more for. That's just one of the traps that grocery stores use to get you to spend more money. You'll likely get fresher fruit and veggies by buying them at the farmer's market or at the grocery store and picking them up at home. Save time. Cut a few days' worth of veggies up at home for a few meals. Well, there you are. It's my job as the purveyor of the wake-up call to give you a few things occasionally to think about, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that has been something food for thought, pun intended, and certainly you will have time on your hands, hopefully not too much time occasioned by unemployment, but ladies and gentlemen, we talk about that too, and I hope I've given you some interesting ideas about all of these different things, and I look forward to doing so again on Monday, and in the meantime, as always, it remains for me to wish you a wonderful weekend. Take care of yourselves. Keep warm. I'll talk to you on Monday. This is Richard Martin at the Wake Up Call saying bye-bye till then.